Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 29th of November. This Saturday is World AIDS Day, and we are going to be paying particular attention to young people in the state of Wisconsin. I don't know if you saw the very thorough article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. 6 out of 10 young people with HIV in this state don't know they have it. Only 22% of sexually active high school students have been treated, and this is according to a new study from the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention. We're going to be looking at why this is the case. HIV hits black youths at a far higher rate than whites. Why is that the case? 60% of new infections in young people occur in African Americans, 20% in Hispanic Latino population, and 20% in the white population. Milwaukee County has seen a 218% increase in the number of HIV cases among young black males, and we'll be talking about how we compare to the national average, but really more importantly, why is it after so many years that we've been talking about this and progress has been made in terms of allowing people to get treatment that allows them to live for a long, long period of time. People remember it wasn't that long ago that people were dying in huge numbers. So why is it that young people are becoming infected at such high rates? We talk about that this hour of our program this Thursday. We have two guests with us. Mike Gifford has been a leading force in the fight against AIDS in Wisconsin for 20 years. He currently serves as the president and chief executive officer of the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin. Thank you, Michael, very much for being with us.
Glad to be back.
Also joining us is Gary Hollander. Gary is the executive director of Diverse and Resilient and owner of Gary Hollander Enterprises, which is a consulting and professional coaching firm. He is also past president and current board member of the Wisconsin AIDS Fund. And Gary's the mission of his organization is the healthy development of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people in Wisconsin. We'll be welcoming phone calls, as we always do, to reach us, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Let's start with this report from the U.S. Center for Disease Control. I guess what's really frightening about this is 6 out of 10 young people, and we're seeing increasing numbers in certain populations, with HIV don't know they have it. They're just not being tested for this. They think they can't possibly get this. What's going on, Mike?
I think it's really startling news, but news that those of us in the fight against HIV have known for some time, and that is that the younger generations really are at great risk for HIV. And unfortunately, what has happened is that with every new generation coming of age and becoming sexually active, we need to educate them, and that's simply not happening. The generation now that's at risk for HIV simply weren't born when Magic Johnson announced publicly his HIV status, and they don't recall the days that many of us do about disease diagnosis and rapid disease progression and death. The threat and fear of HIV is really lost on this younger generation. And
don't we have programs in schools now, Gary?
We certainly do have programs in schools, but those programs may not be in every school. They may not be the young people we're talking about may actually not be regularly attending school as well. So if a program is offered annually and 2 days out of the school year, there's a possibility for exposure to that information, then a young person may not be there and present to get it. But in addition to that, the educational material has to be very specific to that young person's needs. A 14 or 15-year-old doesn't readily do that cognitive switch that's necessary to translate some general scientific information to a very personal, practical application, like getting an HIV test or using a condom or some barrier method. And the problem with that, then, is that we may be teaching about teen pregnancy prevention and hoping that it has an effect on HIV prevention, and it may not.
Mm-hmm. And we haven't been very direct about this because we're still squeamish about the topic, or are there other reasons?
Well, there is a great deal of squeamishness about same-sex behavior and sexual identity in general. Even though there's been great progress in so many ways in terms of acceptance and tolerance of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, a classroom teacher may disagree, or a classroom teacher may agree but not be quite sure that she will be supported by her principal or by the district despite their reassurances. One family member, one parent complaining, someone's aunt complaining could create a big problem for the school year, and the person may be reluctant to be as direct as they need to be.
The figures are particularly dramatic, Michael, among the African-American youth in this community and really around the country. Why are those numbers so high?
Well, I think it starts with what Gary's been talking about in terms of really a lack of education, we need to do that better. The stigma associated with HIV and risk behaviors in the African-American community only confound the situation. And then just the level of risk behaviors that young people really across the board are engaging in all sort of snowball together to these very high HIV infection rates among the African-American community.
Mm-hmm. What about testing? Obviously, testing would curb that rate because you would be able to know that you have this and be maybe a little bit more careful about your activity. Are people just not going? Well, young people don't go to the doctor very much either, so that's another problem. How do we increase testing?
Well, I think that what you just said, Kathleen, is a very important issue, that there are some major structural issues that need to happen in healthcare. Young people don't typically access healthcare unless they're trying to try out for some sport or they've had a major injury. They report to an emergency room long before they see a pediatrician. And we've known for some time that there's this period in early adolescence to mid-adolescence where people, sort even those who are regularly going to a pediatrician, stop going until they're ready to start seeing a family practitioner, other primary care doctor. And so many young people, even in the best of circumstances, don't get that kind of care. So then trying to introduce some kind of clinical service or what appears to be a clinical service like an HIV test seems pretty foreign. Then where would this happen? Testing is certainly widely available, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's truly accessible to a young person. To do that, that service has to be something that's attractive to them, that they don't have to fear what the outcomes are. It's the same reason they may not go to the dentist to find out that they need dental work done. It could be painful. It could be scary for them. And then what are the parents' supports to actually get tested? I think that there is a role for parents, there's a role for schools, and there's certainly a role for community-based and clinical programs like ARCW and Diverse and Resilient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just really want to echo some things that Gary's saying. Access to testing is pretty easy. You know, a test is an easy thing to do in this day and age, the physical process of going through a test, a mouth swab, and results in 20 minutes. What we really need are community leaders to strike up the band around HIV testing and opening up new venues for HIV testing, schools, churches, community centers. We need to look at these sort of non-traditional providers to offer up this service in conjunction with Diverse and Resilient or ARCW or many other organizations in this town that are in and around the state that provide HIV testing so that we can reach out to this population.
Are there any such tests being done in schools, in churches now, or would that be brand new territory?
Well, certainly in churches, and also we provide testing in some other community-based organizations like Pathfinders, which has a very vulnerable youth population. To my knowledge, it's not being done in schools.
What would it take to have that happen? I would imagine that might be difficult.
It would be challenging, I'm sure, but we have to remember what's at stake here. For these young folks, a life with HIV is fraught with challenges. HIV is synonymous with poverty. While there's great hope for care and treatment, access to that care and treatment is difficult. Adhering to the regimens is difficult. You know, at the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin, 1 in 3 of our patients have no health care coverage. Mm. So the idea that HIV, you contract HIV, you take a pill a day and everything's going to be fine, sort of is the great theoretical hope that we all have. The reality is far different than that.
And it's interesting. I don't know if you have exact figures, but when you look at an older population, the number of new infections has gone down substantially, hasn't it?
Well, it's actually been flat to slightly decreased over the last 10 years. Mm. But among young people under the age of 29, there's been a precipitate precipitative growth, where we've seen growth probably about 5 to 10% among whites, 5 to 10% among Latinos, and then well over 150% among African Americans in that age range.
When you talk about a community leader, what are you talking about? You're talking about a public figure who's taking up a campaign, and we see that person on television and on billboards, or what?
Well, I certainly that sort of leadership is important, and I think the work that Diverse and Resilient is doing around stigma and those sorts of issues, particularly in the African-American community with public billboards and such, is important. But it's also opinion leader like individuals, the pastor, the leaders in the family, whether that be an aunt or a grandmother, coaches, anybody who is really viewed with credibility among young people who are particularly at risk for HIV, if they're not engaged in the fight against HIV, especially for young African-American kids in this community, they're really not doing their job of trying to form and lead these kids.
Is there more of a stigma in the African-American community, Gary, to be a gay youth?
Well, you know, that's kind of a contested issue right now, and that's a study that we've been involved with for a couple of years now in conjunction with the University of Wisconsin School of Journalism and Mass Communications in Madison. And one of the things that we've come to is that this seems like the results of the stigma and the degree of stigma may be somewhat different, but stigma is widespread across all racial and ethnic groups. But young people who are African-American, particularly if they're African-American and poor, tend to have greater consequences for that stigma. They might be ejected from their homes. They may be seen as less acceptable, more excluded and less included in family systems, therefore making them more vulnerable to sexual risk.
What do you do about that?
What are we doing about it? Well, we're certainly trying to loop those young people in. When we find out that they are vulnerable, we try to hook them up with and refer them to resources like Pathfinders and other shelters. But in addition to that, we're doing a large public campaign to increase acceptance. We're working with a group of Central City churches to do more outreach and positive statements about the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people in the community. We're doing our billboard campaign acceptance journeys. You probably have seen them around Milwaukee. There have been over 20 million impressions of those billboards over the past year. And in addition to that, we're working with United Way agencies across the city that we work with those groups by giving them story cards where African-American and Latino and white and Asian family members talk about the lesbian, gay, and bisexual people in their lives and their acceptance for them. So we're setting a standard for acceptance, in part because rejection is very clear, but avoidance and mere tolerance also have negative health consequences.
Mm-hmm. So we're assuming here, we probably should have said earlier, that the reason for the incidents is through sexual contact. It is not drug use, or am I mistaken?
No, I think that's a real fair statement. I mean, we in Wisconsin have a pretty progressive approach to preventing HIV among injection drug users. The Clean Needle Exchange Program that ARCW has operated since 1994 has helped reduce new HIV infections among that population by over two-thirds. Here in Wisconsin, just a small percentage, far less than 10% of new HIV infections are related to drug use. A much different story, even if you travel 90 miles south to Chicago, where as many as a quarter of new HIV infections are among injection drug use. So it really is a disease that's driven by sexual behavior.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it something when you think about this? Because I remember doing programs years and years and years ago with you, Gary, and with other people, in which we were just beginning to realize the horrors of this epidemic. And the history is not that old, and yet we have obviously not taught the history to young people. They have no awareness of what so many people have gone through concerning this disease. It's been devastating.
Well, certainly we haven't. I think one of the big challenges to that is how would that education happen? In community settings, very often Lesbian, gay, and bisexual adults are fearful of their interactions with young people because they believe they'd be misunderstood as being provocative sexual relationships when, in fact, they may be educational in their nature. Young people have primary social relationships with other people their own ages, and those peers may not be informed, especially if their peers are heterosexual peers and don't really face the same sorts of consequences for their sexual behaviors. And then in addition to that, they're not widely understood or accepted in schools. I think I would be hard-pressed to be a 16-year-old in any school district today and raise my hand to ask a question about my same-sex behaviors in a health class. While that teacher may certainly be receptive, my peers may not be. And so then my unmet need is going to, you know, continue after the bell rings.
Mm-hmm.
I think another aspect of this, Kathleen, that we really have to point out is even what our national leaders are doing on HIV prevention right now. We're all pleased that the Obama administration in their first term came up with the first ever national HIV/AIDS strategy. Sort of surprising to me that it took about 29 years into the epidemic that we finally were going to have a coherent national strategy on how to prevent HIV and ultimately treat people who are living with HIV and AIDS. And it's a good plan. It was well thought out. I think the Obama administration did a remarkably good job in reaching out to the community to gain a good understanding of the strategies that we need to prevent HIV infection. The challenge is we have a plan, and the federal government has literally done very little, if nothing, different. Federal HIV prevention funding is flat. It's actually been cut for a state like Wisconsin. And yet the primary goal, at least the primary HIV prevention goal within this strategy, is to reduce HIV infections nationally by 25% by the year 2015. We need to understand that doing the same thing with the same amount of resources is not going to create that sort of substantial turn in the AIDS epidemic in this country.
And then in addition to that point that Mike was making, that it is a robust plan and we do support it and get behind it, I think the challenge for it is that the plan really looks at what's going on with the average person in the United States today at risk, at greater risk, who is probably 21 and over. But these young people are still missing that basic foundation understanding of risk. And the current plan really does not support small group and individual personalized education for youth. It just doesn't support it. I don't think it's inconsistent with the plan, but as Mike said, there's no money for it.
We go to phone calls. Let me give our audience the phone number, 800-486-8655. We're talking 2 days before World AIDS Day about a new World AIDS Day. About a new government report, Center for Disease Control, 50,000 new HIV infections in this country each year, 1 in 4 affect people ages 13 to 24, and more than half of those don't know they are infected. So we're looking at what to do about that this hour. There is also some positive news on the World AIDS front, and we will talk about that during this hour as well. The World AIDS epidemic is making progress in prevention and also in improved treatment, so we will get to that as we move along here this hour. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@wpr.org, and the Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, Columbia Records is celebrating its 125th anniversary. It's hard to believe there was any kind of recording 125 years ago, but indeed there was. Sean Wilentz, who's written a lot of books about Bob Dylan and other performers, has written the script to 360 Sound, the Columbia Records story. We will talk with him about the early days of Columbia, and we'll have a chance to hear just a lot of music, too. We'll listen to some Dylan and Benny Goodman and Barbara Streisand, Tony Bennett, Al Jolson, one of their early performers, Leonard Bernstein and the New York Philharmonic. We'll even play Beyoncé. I don't even know what she sounds like, but we're going to play Beyoncé on public radio. Can we rock out to that? Do either of you know Beyonce? Can we rock out?
I know Beyonce quite well. Not personally, but certainly her music.
Okay. All right. We'll have some fun. Our guests this hour are Gary Hollander, Executive Director of Diverse and Resilient, Mike Gifford, Executive Director of the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin, and we start our calls with Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks so much for this program, first of all. I'm old enough now to say that 50 years ago I was 18 years old, okay? And when I was a youth, I knew that I had a future, that I, no matter what my sexual orientation, that I would have jobs offered to me, I would have a family who said they would love me no matter what, and indeed they did. And I also was fortunate enough to be in a social system where people said, you'll find somebody to love. If we don't give youth hope, I'm kind of springboarding off a comment earlier about poverty. We're looking at distinct populations which have high, high unemployment rates. And if we've learned anything about teen pregnancy prevention, or actually even preteen pregnancy prevention, we've learned that we have to show young people that their life has some kind of future to it. And with gay and lesbian youths, frequently I think we're still sending these really negative messages about a disease in society that basically sends messages that you're worthless. We're still fighting over marriage equality. As I said, we're looking at populations with really high unemployment rates. And I'm just thinking back that when I was young, even though I had a prospect of jobs and a lot of social support, when you're young, and I'm not being vulgar here, you sure do find time for sex. You really do. And so I'd like your guests to kind of reflect on the idea that we have to talk not just about this disease as a disease, but the society's attitude towards certain populations as a kind of disease in and of itself.
Thank you, Rich, for your call. Gary.
Rich, thanks so much. I couldn't agree more with what you're saying. I think that the product or byproduct of anti-gay discrimination for many young people is a huge challenge to be hopeful, to remain optimistic about a positive future, and to know or recognize today that they have some positive life options. And in the absence of that hope in those life options, it's very, very difficult to maintain vigilance and use condoms regularly and protect themselves when they are sexually active. And so any time that we can have family members, community members, responsible adults in their lives, support them, show them that they're fine people, direct them to an advanced education that's reasonable, look to them for getting a good job and a career. Anytime that happens, we can bolster the resilience of those young people. The Search Institute in the Twin Cities has done a lot of research over the years and has shown that that when young people, heterosexual young people, lesbian and gay young people, in general, when young people have two or more responsible adults watching out for them very positively and instilling hope and support with them, they tend to have more positive options and results in their lives later on. But when the Youth Risk Behavior Survey that is administered across our country queries young people, all young people, about how many adults, responsible adults, do they look to for support, the lesbian and gay people who answer that questionnaire show significantly fewer have that kind of support, either in school or at home or in the community. And I think you're really touching on something that's incredibly important, Rich.
I think he has too. Thank you, Rich, so much. Devin in Milwaukee, hi.
Hello?
Yeah, hi, Devin.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me. You guys are all great. I'm big fans of everybody on the show. I'm a social worker here in Milwaukee, and I work with young adults, 18 to 24-year-olds. And we provide housing for those young adults and try and teach independent living skills. Sex education is one of those independent living skills that we try to instill. But I would say housing is one of the major preventative actions, I think, that would really help in the city of Milwaukee and throughout Wisconsin. We see so many, our wait lists and our young adults trying to get into these programs are just amazing. And the things that they go through while they're homeless, survival sex, prostitution, all sorts of things to have a couch to sleep on that night, to make some money, to feed any sort of survival tactics that they have. I think it's a major player in stopping the spread of HIV is providing housing for those young adults. I used to work for the AIDS Foundation of Chicago also, and we developed housing for pediatric AIDS, women with children, formerly incarcerated men. I think we really need to be developing more housing practices as a preventative measure on Milwaukee and around Wisconsin. And I guess I wanted to ask our guests today what they're doing to create more preventative programs like that reach, there's these holistic approaches that could reach out to all different groups that are at risk for HIV, especially young adults who are, with this economy at 18, are expected to be out on their own, or if they're LGBTQ, they might get kicked out of the house at 18. You know, there's just so many things out there. I think housing is one of the big things that I would like to see.
And Devin, thank you for the call. It's an area I haven't even thought of. This is such a huge issue, isn't it? Be in touch with us because we'd be interested in hearing more about your work as well. Mike.
Certainly, there are so many social drivers of HIV, and housing is a big part of it. Here in Milwaukee, on any given night, there's about 400 homeless youth, and yet we only have a small number of beds. I can't remember if it's 8 or 16 beds for homeless youth here in Milwaukee. So what Devin is talking about in terms of survival sex or trading sex for shelter is certainly a very high-risk situation for our homeless young people. Certainly HIV is part of that equation, and we need to do better on that. There are so many social determinants that fuel the AIDS epidemic, whether it's homelessness, poverty, addiction, stigma, hunger. And for many of the young people that we've been talking about this morning, or candidly for people with HIV across the board, about 94% of whom live in poverty, if we're not able to address those social issues and overcome those social determinants of health, there's really no reasonable hope for a long and healthy life living with HIV and AIDS. So that holistic approach, I think we do well in Wisconsin for people living with HIV and AIDS. When I think about the ARCW Medical Center and our integrated medical, dental, mental health services, our housing facilities, the rent assistance we provide, the food pantries, and all those sorts of things. And we do need to start looking at, on a community-wide basis, how we can reach out to populations who are at very high risk for HIV and extend these services so that there's hopefully a stabilizing factor in their lives that can help them reduce their HIV risk behaviors. But until those sort of initial layer, if you think about Maslow's pyramid of need, if until those initial layers are met, HIV and concerns about HIV are going to be put off.
Yeah. Devin, my email is dunk@wpr.org. Please message us and we'll find out more about the work you're doing. Michael in Nisida, hi.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if anyone on the panel here has discussed youth talking to other youth, in that is there support here in the state where maybe schools would help educate young people to talk to other young people, and if that would be a good good place to start this education.
Gary.
Michael, that's a great approach, actually. And we have youth health promoters in 5 cities across the state that we support to do exactly the kind of work you're talking about. So we train young people. We have every other year we have a youth leadership institute for 5 days, usually at a university campus somewhere in the state. We have 20 adults who help these young people learn more about sexuality, learn more about HIV prevention and substance use. And then we send them back to their communities with their local adult advisors, and those advisors monitor their work, their outreach work. And then each month they send us reports about the folks they've contacted, the conversations they've had, and the programs they've directed them toward. It is a great, great process. It's labor intensive on the part of the adults to do that work, to make sure it's happening and to see that the young people are well thought of and protected in the efforts they have, and that they maintain some reasonable limits to the type of work they're doing so they don't overstep their skill level. But it is a great approach.
Mm-hmm. And the kind of approach that could be used in schools all over the state if we really were serious about taking on this issue, Mike?
Well, certainly in schools, but as Gary mentioned earlier, young people who are at risk for HIV may not be in those school settings.
Right.
And the community-based programs that Gary was talking about in the five cities around the state, and ARCW is working through the Many Men, Many Voices model of HIV prevention in a comparable way, reach out to young people who aren't in schools. You know, I think we have to remember that when we're talking about young people, that schools end at 18 for almost all kids, and risk behaviors don't, and the need to educate people about HIV continues. So we need to be in the schools, but we also need to be reaching young people outside of those schools.
Thank you, Michael, for your call. Isaiah, is it in Lac des Flambeaux?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi, I just had a couple comments. I think part of the health disparities around HIV and AIDS are a symptom of a greater problem in how we address health care and social services in Wisconsin. I think there needs to be more culturally appropriate HIV-AIDS services provided, and part of that, I think, is building capacity in African-American communities as well as other communities that experience the lowest end of health disparities, and not just providing jobs while a grant is available, but also truly lifting people up and educating them to be public health professionals. When I look around the Department of Health Services or other people who are providing these services, the demographics of the people working there don't really represent those who are affected most by these health disparities. I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks, Isaiah.
Yeah, that's a great great point, Isaiah. And part of the work that we've been doing through Diverse and Resilient is actually to address precisely that. So we have different leadership development groups, one called Grow Great Women, another one called Build, that actually have been operating for 5 or 6 years now. And through these, we actually are working to develop a public health workforce. And we've made sure that people get back to school, that they complete their educations, and that then we employ them or we help them get employed in other organizations. And in fact, a couple of the folks who've gone through those programs are now working for ARCW, and one is working for the state. So, but that is a long-term process, and I think that it's important that you, Isaiah, and others shine a light on this, because developing the public health workforce is a costly thing that cannot be in the long term borne on the backs of community-based organizations. It really needs to be through our educational institutions.
Thanks for the call. Kathy in Stoughton, hi.
Hi there, Kathleen. This is such a great program. Actually, I work in reproductive health here in Wisconsin. And of course, being in reproductive health, I work with a lot of young folks. I mean, we do our part. We do, like, we do over 100 HIV tests a week, probably more than that, and that kind of thing on folks that do come into our clinic. But now it's almost like it's expected that you're going to have sex with every person that you're with or you're hooking up, and I think it's just, like, part of it's the hookup culture. And that is what I really don't see being addressed. I mean, I know that, like, you know, the community educators and things like that, the people that go out into the schools, they do talk about that a little bit, but it's really not being communicated in other channels.
Mike.
As a father of three young girls who are going to be teenagers soon, the information Kathy shares is certainly personally alarming, but should also be alarming to all of us across the state. There are higher levels of risk behaviors occurring in this day and age, and we as a society have to tackle that issue, not only within the context of HIV, but STDs and unplanned pregnancies and those sorts of things.
Gary.
I think that Kathy's point is a great one, but what I'd like to go back to the first thing that she shared, which is that in her clinical setting, they're doing 100 HIV tests a week in a group of, I'm assuming, mostly females and mostly heterosexual. And I think that is one of the important parts of the recent CDC report that's being overlooked, and that is that the greatest need for testing is among males. Because of reproductive health services and the strong work that Planned Parenthood and others have done over decades with a great brand recognition for their name, important resource that they represent in so many Wisconsin cities, young women go there, they know they can go there, and that staff is well-versed in getting them an HIV test. The same system does not exist for males.
Thank you, Kathy, very much for your call. Our phone number, we have a couple lines open. We've been pretty crowded here, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're looking at a report from the CDC that shows that of the 50,000 new HIV infections in this country every year, more than one in four are among people ages 13 to 24. And the situation in Milwaukee is not good, particularly among African-American youth. We're looking at the reasons for that, at what kind of strategies are effective. We're looking at all of the issues that are involved here, including poverty and homelessness and education and the role of public schools, and I could spend the next 15 minutes just talking about all that's involved. More phone calls we'll take in just one moment, 800-486-8655, the email talk@wpr.org, and the Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, Columbia Records celebrating its 125th anniversary. Sean Wilentz will be with us. Sean is a history professor at Princeton, actually. He writes a lot of books about history and the history of music. He's done several terrific books on Bob Dylan. He's done this book, which includes, it's really a big, big book with lots of pictures of stars in the business, Columbia business, going way back to the late 19th century. So Sean will be with us hour two. We have a ton of emails that have come in as well, gentlemen. Let's take this one from Jean. Do we know anything about how the incidence of AIDS is changing on college campuses? Are college students any more likely to know their HIV status? Anybody know?
At least what you have in a college situation is a college health services unit. And as an example, I know at the University of Wisconsin over at Madison, they've got a very active HIV testing program. And that testing is so important, Kathleen, because it allows really a number of things to happen. One, it identifies folks who are living with HIV and allows us to link them into care, giving them that hope for access to effective medical treatments and a long and healthy life. There's two important outgrowths of that. It includes an opportunity to provide HIV counseling, education, risk reduction counseling, so that person who we know is living with HIV is reducing their risks, hopefully resulting in fewer new HIV infections. But we also know that people with HIV who have an undetectable viral load, which is essentially as healthy as you can be living with HIV, your HIV is managed medically as well as it can be, are far less likely to transmit HIV. Some studies show as much as 96% less likely to transmit HIV. So the testing piece that the previous caller, Kathy, talked about and Gary built on is so vitally important as that link to care, which essentially becomes prevention. Treatment as prevention was one of the major themes of the International AIDS Conference that occurred this last summer in Washington, D.C., the first time it's been in America since 1987. And it's an important part of the equation, particularly for these young people who don't have access to health care on a regular basis.
Let's go to Joan in Waukesha. Hi, Joan.
Good morning. I was listening to the program this morning, and I work for Planned Parenthood, and we absolutely do male HIV testing. We do a lot of male services, and I think there was something misspoken about that we don't do male HIV testing.
Well, to clarify, Joan, I'm not saying that Planned Parenthood doesn't do it. What I'm saying is that reproductive health services for women have been emphasized, for well over 100 years. We can look back to early magazines and various print materials from the late 19th century that have talked about women's reproductive health. And that's translated through the work of Margaret Sanger and other pioneers in the field over the decades. And here in Wisconsin, Fran Way and others who are grandparents of Planned Parenthood here have done a wonderful job of making sure that women's reproductive health is managed. And while Planned Parenthood and others still do a good job of making sure that men's reproductive health is addressed, it is insignificant in comparison to women's access to reproductive services, not because of Planned Parenthood, but because there is no culture for it.
Hmm. I don't know if I agree with that, simply because I see a lot of male patients in our practice, and I feel they know that we're someplace they can turn to, that they can get a lot of services through us. So I'm sure that women's health has been the focus, and men's health may not have been a focus. I can agree with you there. But I think men are starting to realize that they have access in certain areas, and especially at Planned Parenthood.
Thank you very much for the call. And I guess we're talking about a subset of the population, too. We're looking at people who are not going to any kind of health services, right? They're just they're poor, and they're maybe homeless, some of them, and they just aren't going to have any testing done because of all the circumstances of their lives.
You know, I think it's a good point that you're making about there does seem to be a hidden Milwaukee. And I think that if you're in this work, you start to see that hidden Milwaukee. And I'm a lifelong resident here, 64 years of life in Milwaukee, and I am constantly surprised about the parts of the city, not geographic locations, but times of day and little hidden things that we find all the time. My office is on Holton Street, and we have people stop at our door frequently asking not for immediate help, but for shelter. And, you know, they just need a place tonight. Or we find a 5- or 6-year-old who was dropped off by a school bus, and it's not their neighborhood.
Oh,
and they look at our storefront, and they come to us. And I think that people don't know that Milwaukee exists.
Yeah.
And it does. And those folks are at great risk. They are at the edge, and they're looking to survive.
Yeah. All right, let's go to John in Madison. Hi, John.
Hi. Well, I missed part of the show. I don't know if you discussed the home kits to test for HIV/AIDS, whether they're effective or how much they cost or whether anybody advises getting them now. My second question is concerning the average cost to treat AIDS per year per person. Also, I'm interested in the life expectancy now of the person with HIV/AIDS with the best possible treatment. And lastly, you indicated that 10% of the new cases are due to contaminated needles. I would be also interested in what is the percentage of new cases in the heterosexual versus the homosexual community.
Okay. Mike.
Lots of great questions there, John. Let's start with the home HIV testing. Right now in the fight against AIDS, one of the most important things anybody can do is get an HIV test, particularly if you've engaged in a high-risk behavior. And we need to open up every avenue possible for that HIV test. And the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin really welcomes the new home HIV test. The challenge with it is how it is implemented. And for those outlets that are going to be selling those tests, I believe they have the responsibility to make sure that but they are also educating the consumers who are purchasing those tests of the services of Diverse and Resilient and the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin and other community resources. But we have to take down every barrier possible to HIV testing. It is interesting, the CDC report that came out yesterday used what I thought was a relatively low lifetime cost for HIV at about $400,000. A number of years ago, Duke University did a study that showed that it was about 50% higher than that, that the lifetime cost was really closer to $600,000. And we know that people with HIV who get into care and treatment, take their medications every day at the right time, are seeing their physician regularly, taking good care of themselves, have an opportunity to have quite a long life expectancy. Some projections show almost a near normal life expectancy. So that cost of HIV care and treatment is only going to go up with that as people living with HIV longer.
And I think that the home test has, as Mike said, some great opportunities, options for people with the resources to purchase them. They do cost between $40 and $60 a piece, and I can't think of a teenager that we work with who would have that amount of disposable income. And in fact, for teens who would come to see us for a test, who are part of this target population, they would actually get a stipend to support their getting the test, and they would get counseling and education that went with it, and follow-up services, and referrals to social support systems and networks. So I think that there's a specific niche that's appropriate and that the home test fills, but I think that there are many parts of the population it's not the best match.
Yeah. And can we spend a little more time on heterosexual population? Anne in Madison emailed, do we add to the problem of AIDS infection by marginalizing it as a predominantly a homosexual issue? If I'm straight, I don't need to worry attitude. What's the growth in infection rates among young heterosexual women?
In the 1990s, women represented 6% of HIV infections in the state of Wisconsin. And in the 1990s, it grew to 16%. And since the turn of the century, it's been about 25%. It is a minority of new HIV infections, but it is a growing aspect of it. And we also have to, you know, step back and think about the broader context. The city of Milwaukee is regularly named one of the highest STD rates in the country, and obviously HIV and STDs are oftentimes spread by the same diseases, or I'm sorry, by the same behaviors, and we have to always be cautionary around any behaviors that people engage in that put themselves at risk for HIV, because we could easily see a rapid growth of HIV among that population.
We have about a minute remaining. Another report, UN report, came out this week showing that, just to put it very succinctly, the global response to the worldwide AIDS epidemic is making remarkable progress in prevention and improved treatment.
It really is remarkable progress. I mean, this was highlighted again at the International AIDS Conference. There's over 8 million people in developing countries who are now in HIV care and treatment. I strongly believe that we owe that to the good work on international AIDS issues that was done by President George W. Bush and the President's Emergency Relief Plan, particularly as it relates to care and treatment. Unfortunately, what happened is we took the eye off the ball, or our federal policymakers took their eye off the ball as it relates to HIV domestically. And we're starting to see that with these increases in Wisconsin, as I think a prime example of it. If we're investing billions and billions and billions of dollars internationally in the fight against HIV, and we're still not increasing the resources here, it is a reason why we're seeing an increase here.
Yeah, something's off, right? That seems so obvious.
Certainly, I'm glad to see the worldwide leadership that the United States is taking with, you know, well over 30 million people affected with HIV internationally. And I think we have an important role to play. And I know that we are lauded internationally for the role we play. But we also have to remember that this epidemic is just not happening in sub-Saharan Africa. It's happening here in Milwaukee and among a very vulnerable population.
Yeah, which we learned so much about. Thank you both so much. It was a difficult hour, but so important. Thank you for all the information and for the work you're doing.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Yeah, our pleasure. Our thanks to Mike Gifford, Executive Director of the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin. Gary Hollander is Executive Director of Diverse and Resilient. We'll put both of their information, email addresses, et cetera, on our Facebook page. So if you want more information about the good work they're doing, our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who produced this program. We'll be with you and with some tunes following the news.